It's Gone Sideways.
We are back with Shit's Gone Sideways. I am here with Robbie Eagles, professional wrestler, the sniper of the skies. Robbie, thanks for coming on.
No worries. Thanks for having me on.
Man, I'm really excited to have you here today. I think that, you know, there's been just a huge growing interest in Australia and around the world in professional wrestling over the last few years. And, I mean, you're at the forefront of it, I guess, in Asia Pac, and it seemed like a topic that I know nothing about. I'd love to just hear about your journey, because it's just I can't understand just that journey. How do you go from being like me? We both like grew up watching, you know, WCW and NWO, all this kind of stuff, and thinking, oh man, these guys are crazy. But then you were like, actually, that's what I'm going to dedicate my life to.
Yeah, it was always like a lifelong dream, I guess. Like, I remember being in primary school and drawing myself as a professional wrestler when they said, draw yourself as your dream job or what you're going to do when you grow up.
Yeah.
And I did that, and everyone thought the typical thing, it's a phase, he'll grow out of it.
Yeah, I did firefighter, you know, fighter pilot, all those kind of stuff, but never actually ended up going anywhere near that. But that's pretty cool to have this vision as a kid and actually follow through with it. That must be like a very, very, very small amount of people that do that.
I think so. Being honest about it anyway, I'm sure there's probably others out there.
Yeah.
They're just not as upfront about doing it like I did.
What's the secret to having a vision when you're so young and maintaining it all the way through?
Well, it definitely changed. Yeah. I mean, I don't look anything like the drawing that I drew in grade 4. I would be pretty worried if I did, because the body parts weren't, you know, to spec. So like the head was larger than the body. I'd be worried about where I would be looking.
Huge cock.
I went through that phase in about grade 5, not grade 4.
So tell me about where it all began. So you've been wrestling now for about, 14 years?
Yeah, almost 15.
Wow. And so you started when you were 18?
Yes. Right? Yeah, straight out of high school, graduated in 2007.
Yeah.
Took a couple months to end that year, and then January 2008 I started training.
Okay, so what was the moment when you decided that you actually wanted to go and start training?
So the thing that I did that probably wouldn't come up on many websites and stuff, so you might not be privy to this information, is I did what's called backyard wrestling, where you basically just start your own sort of league on whatever you can build in like a makeshift ring.
Yeah. Just with mates?
Yeah, it was mostly – so like 14 years old, it was just with friends from school that were also kind of into wrestling. We'd just find like random foam mattresses or whatever and just kind of recreate the moves. But there was actually a group in Newcastle called HVWA that had a home-built ring. One of the guy's dads was like still in steelworks.
What is HVWA?
It stands for Hunter Valley Wrestling Alliance. And the funny thing is there's plenty of videos of us on the internet that still have hundreds of thousands of views. Because we were quite popular around the world, and we didn't really realize it at the time because it was 2005. The internet was still kind of like burgeoning, not really what it is now.
Did you have performers' names even back then?
Yes, we did. We had wrestlers' names.
What was your name?
My name was James Cyanite, which was like a play on the word cyanide. I think I was just stupid and didn't know how to spell cyanide, so I just spelt it how I thought it sounded.
Reminds me of like when you created your first email address and you look back and it's like just cringy, but you still love it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, the emails I used to have back then, and everyone, you know, if you follow a rugby league team, it's like South Sydney Rabbitohs Lover 104 or whatever it is. But my wrestling name wasn't that bad. It was okay. It was doable.
Yeah.
But we had like a makeshift ring, and I would travel 3 hours on the train to Newcastle, do this backyard wrestling match, and then travel 3 hours back on the train home and get home at like 1 a.m. as like a 15, 16-year-old because I was so passionate about it. And I knew you had to be 18 to start training. So I was like, how can I do this before that happens? So I just DIY'd it, made it happen.
Were you doing that with friends traveling, or were you just doing it traveling solo?
At first it was solo, and then I started getting some of my local buddies to come with me, and they'd either just watch or they'd participate as well.
Because that's pretty hectic doing that journey. How old did you say?
15 to 17 years old is when I was doing that regularly.
Traveling solo on your own at 15, 16 to go and wrestle. That just sounds wild.
Yeah. It took me as far to Melbourne. Yeah. I went to Yalambi, which is like in the sticks of the suburbs in Melbourne, caught a flight over, and, you know, I'd do a weekend of backyard wrestling events. So it was like It was kind of like an entry level. We thought we knew what we were doing and we were just kind of so passionate about this thing, but we couldn't do it professionally for whatever reason.
Were you living with your parents at the time?
Yeah, I was still living with mum.
And have you got siblings?
I've got one older sister.
Okay. And so what are they saying when you're like, you're traveling to do this stuff?
I think what happened was my sister, because she's 4 years older, she kind of went through the rebellious teen years before I did.
Yeah, okay.
Mum copped it from her end. So then when it came to me, she just went, I'm sure it'll be okay, and just like let it slide.
Yeah, okay. So she'd forged a path that made it easier for you.
Yeah, yeah. My sister got through all the shit so that when I got to the stage where I was like, hey, I want to do this, Mum was just like, yeah, sure, I'm sure it'll be fine.
Yeah. I was just going wrestling. That's fine.
Yeah, Mum, I'm just meeting these people on the internet and I'm going to go wrestle with them in Newcastle and you're probably not going to be able to contact me because I have no credit.
At their house, yeah.
Yeah.
And so that went on for a few years until you were 18.
Yeah. So the downfall of backyard wrestling, right, like this was my major thing, was if it rained, it got called off. It was like any other outdoor sport, really. Yeah, so wow. Like – I would show up. There was a couple of times that I did this. I did the travel to Newcastle. It would be raining. All the local boys would be like, all right, we're going home. And I'd be stuck there at my mate's Jean's house going, okay, do I just go home now? And he's like, yeah, man, I'm going to go to bed.
Devastating.
And I'm like, sick. Didn't get to wrestle. And then 6 hour round trip. Let's go. So for me, it was always like, look, I always had the dream to do it professionally.
Yeah.
And the bonus of doing it professionally is it's indoors.
Yeah.
So you're not weatherbound by any means. So yeah, I mean, once I finished school, I don't really have any aspirations to go to uni. I didn't really know what I wanted to do for like a job or anything like that. So I was just like, fuck it. Like I found a local place that was 15 minutes on the train that was a wrestling academy near me and signed up, and the rest is history.
So even when you were 15, 16, 17 doing this stuff in the backyards, I mean, how did you pick up – how do guys develop their skills?
It's a lot of tape study, I guess. Kind of the same as like, say, a rugby team reviewing what they did the last weekend.
Yeah,
okay. We would kind of break things down that we were watching that was inspiring us and slow-mo it. And then we'd like practice reenacting it and try and get the movements down. So we were very like technical with it, I guess. Mm. We weren't just trying to pick each other up and just hope for the best and slam each other. We were really trying to make it look as professional as possible when we were like self-taught.
Yeah. So it wasn't. It wasn't just no holds bar competition to smash each other. You were out there really trying to look, you were out there basically at school together, wrestling school.
Correct. Yeah, we were teaching each other. One of the guys was pretty good with like body positioning and movement, and I think he had like a little bit of karate background, so he knew how to break fall. He knew how to like do some things safely. And then we really just kind of like worked it out and we went, hey, we want to make it look as good as what we're watching on TV or as good as what we're watching on the internet. So let's just make it look as good as possible. And that was our aim. So we were basically just recreating the matches that inspired us and trying to make it look like a fluent performance from start to finish, not just film this bit, stop recording, watch it back. Okay, let's do the next bit. We were trying to do it as like a whole thing so that there was a time and place that we were told you guys should put on an actual show, like rent a hall and rent a local ring and put on a show yourselves. And we're like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. And I'm so glad we never did, because we would have embarrassed ourselves terribly.
I remember being like, how old, 15, 16, and seeing like Kevin Nash do like a jackknife powerbomb, and like we're all sort of like, yeah, let's try that. And, you know, just you do that and people get hurt, or just like you have fun doing it for a few minutes and then run out of puff. But, you know, to hear, you know, that just it became such an obsession that you're doing this all the time, practicing moves. I imagine that's how you get better at it, right? It's just by having an interest in these moves and practicing them again and again and again until you start to become really good at it.
Yeah, and that's basically the same as like professional training, is it's all just reps.
Yeah.
So it's just you learn the technique and then you just practice it over and over and over again until it looks right, feels right, and then if you put it side by side – like that Kevin Nash jackknife powerbomb, if you put yours side by side with his and it looks identical, then you know you're doing it correctly.
Yeah. So so tell me, so at 18 you joined, what was it, the Wrestling Academy?
Yeah, the Eagles Wrestling Academy was where I started.
Yep. And so tell me a bit about that. So, I mean, what did it feel like on the first day joining it?
It was very nerve-wracking because I'd never been in any sort of environment like that. So I'd been to a couple of PWA shows at that time to check out basically the company that I would be wrestling at full time afterwards.
And did you explain to them that you'd been doing the backyard wrestling?
No, so I kept it a secret because there's a stigma in professional wrestling. If you come in and say, hey, I'm a backyard wrestler, they just beat the piss out of you. They'll stretch you, they'll beat the piss out of you, take liberties. It was just very much a thing that I had read in books, I had seen in documentaries. So I was like, no, I'm going to keep that under wraps. I like scoured the internet and deleted everything that was possibly found that had me in it. I was like, no, get rid of it, take it down. I wanted to have a fresh slate because I wanted to come in with the best sort of reputation possible.
Okay. So you positioned it as your knowledge to that date was just academic.
Yes. Right? Yeah. Like I'm just a big fan. All I've done is watch it. But I remember Madison, one of my main trainers for all these years, on my first day, we were just doing some like rolling drills, which is very simple. It's almost like gymnastic style stuff.
And she's like, you're really good at this.
Yeah. She's like, are you sure you haven't trained anywhere else before? And I'm like, yes, I'm sure. I'm sure. Just trying to not reveal it. But unfortunately, 8 months later, a friend of mine that I had made through another friend that was once a backyard wrestler turned pro, he was in Adelaide, his buddy was on a show with a bunch of my peers from Sydney, and he kind of spilled the beans on who I was, thinking they all knew.
He snitched.
Yeah, so 8 months later, I remember I got a text from my trainer and it was like, hey, your buddy spilled the beans on you. And I'm like, oh, shit, turn up to training that Monday. And they're all doing, like, I used to do this, like, pose where I'd put a gun under my mouth because I thought it was edgy and cool.
Yeah.
And everyone at training just goes, oh, and I'm like, fuck. But they're all really cool about it, so.
I think after that time you'd already been with them for 8 months, it probably wasn't be as a bigger deal because you'd earned some credibility from training with them.
Right? Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. So if I had come in day one and said, I know what I'm doing, you don't have to show me, it would have been a different story. Totally. But because I kind of went, no clean slate, I don't know anything, teach me. And they kind of respected that. And then they were like, okay, now show us all the videos. And I was like, oh fuck.
Yeah. You came in humble and not trying to act like you knew better than them.
Correct, yeah.
And so how often did you train with these guys?
So it's always been kind of the same, but training was around 3 to 4 times a week. Mm-hmm. It was different kind of levels of like advanced, intermediate, all that sort of stuff.
And how long does a session go for?
Sessions go for about 2 to 3 hours.
That's long.
So yeah, weeknights, usually Monday to Thursday from 7 to 10 p.m. And I just show up every day. I didn't have a real job. I was working at a supermarket part-time, so I had like super easy access to just like go do whatever I wanted as an 18-year-old. And I just kept showing up until they were like, okay, you need to take a day off. Don't come
so
for one day next week.
You could be doing like 12 to 15 hours of wrestling a week.
Yeah, pretty much. Wow. Yeah. And that's how within 2 months of training, I had my first match, which is pretty like ridiculous in the scheme of things. It's like you're learning something new. Mm. And although I had that kind of background beforehand, but for a lot of wrestlers, you don't progress that quickly to having your first performance. So,
and was that your first performance that was in front of a actual audience?
Yeah, in front of a packed 300 to 400 plus audience in the Ingleburn RSL, which was local to me, you know, full of Westies, South Westies.
Yeah.
It's probably the most nervous day in my life.
They must have loved you as a local boy.
Well, I was what's called a heel, so I was a bad guy. Okay. So as much as I wanted them to love me and a lot of my friends were there in attendance, I had to, you know, flip them and make them hate me, which was pretty easy as well.
What do you do to be a heel?
Well, I mean, for me, I thought it was just, I have long hair. That's all I need. It's edgy. It's cool. We actually started the match out with, so I was wrestling Troy the Boy. He was a veteran of professional wrestling in Australia.
Shout out to Troy the Boy.
Yeah. Big shout out to Troy. I don't know what he's doing now, but he came out and then I've come out of this scummy little Robbie Eagles and people are like, who's this kid? Who's this kid? I've got this jacket and I won't take my hands out of my pockets. And the referee's like, you got to take the jacket off. You got to take the jacket off. And I'm like, all right, well, help me take it off from the back. And as the referee's back's turned, I just get white powder and throw it in Troy the Boy's face before the bell rings. So he's blinded the entire match. And that's usually something that would end a match or be at the ending of a match. So we did this whole match where Troy's just trying to find me, can't see through his eyes.
Oh, man.
And it was actually great. Like it was probably the best way I could have started my career, playing so heavily into like a story aspect rather than having to really worry about the technique.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like a pretty quick way to be the villain, right?
Absolutely. It sets the tone right from the get-go. So that's what we needed to do.
I think anyone that's watching that and thinking of a sportsmanship and then you blind the guy in the first few seconds. You're like, I hate this guy.
Yep, that's the reaction we wanted and that's the reaction we got.
That's interesting. So, I mean, I did want to ask about that because obviously a huge part of wrestling is not only the technique but also, I guess, the performance side of it and building these kind of characters, the personas. Is that something which you were already learning about in the training as well? Because obviously you're talking about something like being portrayed as the villain, as the heel. When do you start to learn about that kind of stuff?
Yeah, pretty much from day one. So you're learning the technical aspect of it all and the movements, but then you're also going, okay, so once you know how to do, say, a drop kick or a body slam, how would you then, like, what's your before and after? Mm. It's all about facial and body expressions. So, you know, as you can do it clean cut versions of like clean cut good guy, clean cut bad guy, like what's the standard? And then you can go, okay, well, I'm going to snarl if I'm a bad guy, because that's going to make most people go, oh, he looks like a dick. Like how dare he revel in the fact that he's just slammed this guy. And then as a good guy, you might just be really energetic and very cheerful and jovial. So we were definitely learning that as you went, and then you'd kind of form your own path and be like, okay, well, as a smaller guy, when I was the bad guy, I was very much the chicken shit. So I'd hit, duck, and then I'd get the fuck out of there and be like, okay, I'm just going to stand on the outside for as long as I can until the guy tries chasing me around. I'd scream and yell, like go really high pitched sometimes as well to try and get that like visceral reaction from the audience. But it was just, yeah, finding your own way was definitely the thing that you had to put your own spin on.
It's so interesting hearing you talk about that, because I mean, there's all those subtle things that you see when you watch a professional wrestling match that you see, but you don't really take in, the fact that they're pulling all these, other than the moves, there's all these face expressions and personality bits that add to the performance that you don't really, you enjoy, but you don't know why.
Yeah. They're the subtleties that we really work on, especially, someone having been in it for 15 years. That's the thing that I've got to progress on constantly, not so much the technical or the moves or what I do in the ring. It's more, okay, so if my character is going to have a slight change in his traits or he's got a new rivalry with someone different, how do I portray that?
Yeah.
So it's not just the body's change, but everything else is the same.
Yeah.
Also, like if I really hate someone in the ring, I've got to make sure that I can bring that emotion out without just having a monologue in the ring of, I really hate you, because that's almost too over the top.
Yeah.
I've got to convey that with this, with my face and with my actions.
Yeah. So, I mean, what are the tricks to that?
I guess it's just, it's practice makes perfect.
Yeah.
It's trying something and, you know, very much like any other live entertainment. You try something, does it hit? No. Okay. Do you try it again? Maybe. And then if it doesn't hit the second time, maybe you try changing it.
Yeah.
But then I always, as someone that trains a lot of the younger wrestlers today, I tell them to not watch wrestling for that inspiration. I go, well, what we do is kind of like just 2 hours of action scenes from like Die Hard or whatever. And it's like, so if Bruce Willis is, you know, thriving in pain and he's like in agony, what's his face doing? Mm. Like, look at that sort of stuff. And then that's what you want to bring to the table in your performance. So it's very much taking the other pop cultural references from TV and film especially, and then going, okay, so if you're inspired by this movie, take something from that movie and bring it to your performance. So yeah, it's just anything that's not wrestling, because then if we just study wrestling, what we do is we fall into wrestling tropes.
Yeah, okay.
And then it gets very like cringy and obvious.
What are some of the cringiest tropes?
Oh, I mean, I could go on and on. There's like stereotypical performances that we might do, especially in front of a crowd that's not familiar with pro wrestling or they haven't seen it live very often. And it works, but then if you do it night after night, then people catch on to your shtick and know what you're kind of going for. So there's like, you know, certain elements of storytelling in it where it might be the bad guy is showing that he's maybe the more wily veteran. So he's getting the first body slam and then he gets the first suplex and he's really like, you know, gloating to the crowd after each one. Mm. And then what you'll see is the good guy come up afterwards and hit all those moves in a succession. So not separately, he'll hit the body slam, he'll hit the suplex. And then here's a third move that the bad guy wasn't able to hit. And then the bad guy will roll out being like, where the hell did that come from? So it's just like there are certain acts that can come to the fold as tropes, but they do change year after year.
Yeah. I was interested when you were saying like this idea of playing the villain or the good guy. I mean, is it more fun to be the villain?
I think most people would say that, but I generally for the last, I mean, I can't even count how many years. I'm pretty much just a good guy these days.
Yeah.
And I find that's my bread and butter because there's certain things that I do that maximize performance as the good guy.
Yep. Like what?
So I'm really good at getting beat up, which is, you know, not great for my body. But getting sympathy as the good guy is 100% something that can really make or break your match. So if you want to get a certain reaction at the end or in the middle, it all determines on that sympathy that you get from the crowd. So if you're getting beat up, but you're getting no sympathy, then no one's going to give a shit you're getting beat up.
Yeah.
And then if you have that triumphant return to form and you start, you know, nailing a comeback on the other guy, then that's when the crowd's really behind you because they've gotten that sympathy for you when you're down. So they want to see you rise again. Much like I just referenced in like Die Hard movies, you see Bruce Willis bleeding, pissing out blood, glass all over him. But then, you know, he's going to start just, you know, shooting motherfuckers and like going to town. And that's what you're waiting for. So it's very much just building that anticipation.
I mean, when I was thinking about villains, I was thinking about Alan Rickman, like in Die Hard, right? Because he always talked about how much fun he had being a villain in movies. I can imagine that would be a lot of fun. But I also seen in some of your clips, this what you're talking about with getting beaten up and then you starting like war cries, you know, going Aussie, Aussie, Aussie or Robbie, Robbie, Robbie.
Yep.
And I thought, wow, I mean, yeah, if they have the crowd behind you doing that, it must give you such energy in the performance.
It really does. There's been times where I've just been right before going out for the match, I'm so tired, especially if you're on later in the card. Like it's a long day, generally speaking. And for me, like I'll wake up, I'll go to the gym, I'll do all my errands. Sometimes I'm like literally printing merchandise right before getting to the venue.
Yeah.
So it's like a whole day thing. And then you get there, the doors open, and then you're not like doors open, say 8 o'clock, but you're not on till 9:30. I'm buggered. Like I've been doing this for 15 years. I'm not 22 anymore. I'm 32. So it's a whole different story for me. So like right before going out, sometimes I'm half falling asleep going, fuck, how am I going to get through this? And you go out there, the adrenaline starts and you're like, okay, I think I got this. And then when you hear the audience behind you in that sort of way, especially when they do the Robbie, Robbie, Robbie chant with me, that really like G's me up and it gets me going. So even if I was feeling super flat at that moment, there's no way that I can't just be amped up.
And then by the end of it, you must be absolutely buzzing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's sometimes where like I'll come back and I'm like, fuck, can I go out and just do another match? Can we just like change the script and just like, let's just give them a bonus match when it finishes. We'll go off air and then we'll do a special one. And people are like, no, we can't do that. Rob, settle down. I'm like, yeah, my adrenaline's just peaking. I just want to go again. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go.
Are there things that you need to do to maintain your passion and interest and excitement in the every kind of wrestling performance? Because I mean, me, I've only been doing comedy for 8 months, and even now I find that sometimes I just get bored of doing the same jokes. I have to constantly be doing new stuff or trying it in different ways just to maintain my own interest, let alone to entertain people in front of me, right? And I thought, if you've been doing it for over a decade, there must be things that you need to do just to kind of just keep that passion alive.
Yeah, no, you definitely have to change. You got to evolve as well. Like looking at the matches I had in my first year in 2008 versus the matches that I have now, they're night and day. They're so different because my style has evolved. I've added new techniques. I've taken techniques away. And it's just very much crowd engagement as well is the main thing. So no matter what we're performing for, we do a lot of live streaming for PWA, the company that I work for locally here in Sydney. So we know that we've got like a television audience that we're presenting to, but the main one that I'm always wrestling for is those in the seats at the venue, because they're the ones that are actually reacting live for you. So it's about how can I engage with them? So what I've found over my career is the main thing is I'm like, okay, I didn't always have that Robbie, Robbie, Robbie chant. That was actually started by someone in the crowd.
Yeah.
And then I was just like, this is great. I'm going to run with it. Yep. And then they actually just naturally came along. So that was something that was just like, between me and the fans kind of came to the forefront. And now I'm like, okay, so what can I do to engage with them? And it's all based on, okay, what's the other person doing? Is there something I can play off that they're doing that I can then use as crowd engagement? Or is there someone in the crowd that's just giving me shit or giving the other guy shit? Can I play off that?
Yeah.
So it's very much like dealing with, I guess, like a heckler in the crowd from a comedy show, right?
Totally.
And it's like, how do you play that off? So that's what I'm going into it. Because I can go, we're going to do, you know, A to Z in terms of the performance.
Yeah.
But it's all about those in-betweens and what's going to happen. We don't know how, like, we can't predict that stuff. How are they going to react to it? Sometimes it's flat. Sometimes it's up here. Yeah. If it's up here, you just keep going. But if it's flat, you go, shit, I need to do something so that they're into this. And it might be something like really out of the blue. Like, I could have the most straightforward technical wrestling match. It's so like hold for hold. It's like a wrestling fan's wet dream, but the crowd's not buying it. Mm. And then I just slip some sort of element of comedy in there by playing off something that happened, like the guy might be evading me a whole bunch, so I start dancing around like a chicken and, like, you know, clucking at him, and then the crowd's like, oh, this is great, he's acting like a chicken, which is so hokey pokey. Yeah. But it worked. It's, so I'm, yeah, like, okay, shit, that's what I needed to do, drop the seriousness for like 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. And then we'll bring them back.
Yeah, so definitely part of it is just being in the moment of what's going on in the room.
100%. And that's the hardest thing for young wrestlers, is they're so focused on kind of what the next step is, mm, or what the next thing in the performance is to do, that they don't always revel in the moment and they don't react to the moment. So that's what we try and train them to do, is just have what you want to do in the back pocket, yeah, but listen to the audience, watch the audience, and like watch the room, because you always want to play to the whole room.
What's that balance between when you're up against an opponent, do you have some kind of discussion on that there's certain moves that you want to get done, but then there's also a huge amount of just, it's going to be improvised when you're in there? Is that?
It's all based on your kind of skill level.
Yeah.
You and your, I guess your dance partner, as, yep, you would put it. Some people like to ad lib the whole thing, mm, which is a great skill to have, but then sometimes that can cause a lot of error or room for error.
What do you prefer?
A bit of both. Yeah. I like to know kind of where we're going, because I like to have, for me, it's all about the story. What are we trying to tell with this, I guess, like, story from start to finish of the, yeah, match? There's got to be some sort of kind of like, there's peaks and valleys, yeah, and then how do we portray that?
Yeah.
So if we don't know where we're going, we might not hit those peaks and valleys. So, mm, I like to know at least the gist of, you know, where are we ending? Where are we starting? And then what can we do in the middle to kind of build to all of that? But I definitely like to ad lib as well. But it's all, I kind of play that by ear. Who am I wrestling? What sort of skill level are they, and how comfortable will they be in that situation?
How do you create, I mean, I've seen that you've had wrestling matches that have gone over half an hour, right? And so how do you create those peaks and valleys in a 30-minute wrestling match? I guess where there's got to be times when the tide is constantly turning, you don't know who's going to win. Right. How do you kind of plot that out, like, to create a match to where people are like, holy shit, that was amazing?
Yeah, it's, you know, again, like, sometimes you might go, yes, this and this is going to work. Yeah. Awesome, let's go with that.
Yeah.
And you go out there and the crowd just does not give a shit.
Yeah,
like, okay, they're not into it at all. And you go, fuck, okay, so I thought, my perspective said this is what's going to work. Mm. But my perspective is my perspective, and it's not the audience's.
Have there ever been any times where you've seen that, right? You've been in the ring, that's been happening. You're like, the crowd aren't loving it as much as we thought they were going to, and you've just switched it up. You've done something to improvise because you're like, fuck, this isn't working. Let's try something different.
Yeah, I mean, all the time. Mm. And that's why I like to have that ability to ad lib throughout. Mm. If I just come in with just a plan and it's like a rehearsal, and that's, yeah, – that's, I think, the misconception with pro wrestling is everyone thinks that it's like choreographed.
Yeah.
And it's definitely not, because there are times where we come in and you barely meet the person you're wrestling before you go out there.
Yeah.
I've had matches where my opponent's shown up the match before us, mm, and they're literally putting on their costume, and you just kind of say, hey, I'm Robbie. Hey, I'm such and such. All right. See you out there. And, yeah, that's it. So, yeah, you don't have that ability to choreograph anything. You just got to hope that the way they've trained is similar to the way you've trained, so that we're going to do everything almost the kind of same way.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I mean, like, anything can and will go wrong.
Yeah.
It does quite often. But because of that, you got to run with the punches. So you might predict something happens where you stay in the ring, and then, especially when you're wrestling someone new, they fall out. And you go, how did they fall out? But then you got to play that off. You, yeah, can't be there like deer in the headlights going, oh, shit, that wasn't supposed to happen.
You got
to
roll with it.
Exactly. So, like, there's two ways you can go with it. You can, like, make fun of them, mm-hmm, for falling out and, yeah, kind of play with the crowd that might be already on that side. Or you can kind of act concerned for them and then have them turn the table on you. And it's like, oh, shit, I shouldn't have been such a nice guy and tried to help them out when they had an accident. So there's so many different things and different ways that you could take it. But, yeah, you have to be able to react as things happen. Otherwise, you know, that's sometimes the best moments in a wrestling match is the stuff that you didn't even account for.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting hearing you talk about that idea of like it's not at all choreographed. I guess it's just you might have a base level of training in how to wrestle against each other, right? And you've got you might have a discussion on a couple of moves that you want to try when you're out there, or those kind of is that kind of conversations that you might have?
Yeah, definitely. Like we might say, I might do this, and this.
Yeah.
But if we don't have time for it, if we do have time for it, or if it just falls into place into a different section, then we're going to do something different. Because time is definitely a major thing for us.
Yes.
You can't go over time because what happens is it cuts into somebody else's time.
Yeah, got it.
And that can be a major factor for the show. And essentially for places like PWA where I wrestle here in Sydney, we're all a family. Mm. So if I do something that makes my match go from 15 minutes to 20, that's going to cut 5 minutes somewhere else into the show. Mm. And I know that's one of my pals.
Yeah.
I don't want to, you know, especially if I'm not on last, if I'm taking 5 minutes away from the main event, they should have all the time on the show because they're the attraction match.
Yeah.
So I never do that. So it's all about, I may want to do all the moves I've got.
Yeah.
But I've only got 10 minutes.
Sure.
So I've got to be just mindful of that.
Pick a few of the hits.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Sometimes it literally is the greatest hits. What do the fans know from Robbie Eagles?
Yeah.
Right. They're going to get 1, 2, and 3, and then they're going to be happy.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, it's interesting, I think, when you see the discussions that have been in public and in the media and on social media about wrestling these days, that I remember 10 years ago, even just people talking about, oh, wrestling is fake. That's how it's perceived. But I think, I mean, maybe the movie The Wrestler helped, and I think also just stories that have come out about wrestlers dying in the ring, obviously, or getting serious injuries. People are saying, hold on, I don't think that's fair to say that it's fake. You might say that it's, you know, that there's a predetermined winner of the match, or there might be some stuff which is prearranged in terms of set moves and all that kind of stuff, but you can't say it's fake because these guys are really putting their bodies and their lives on the line. Do you think that there's been a kind of a shifting, more positive perception of wrestling in the broader public?
I definitely think so, because I think everyone's more accepting of it. And when they attend or they watch it, they know what they're watching now.
Yeah.
So I think maybe 10, 15 years ago, it was still kind of like, oh, wrestling's fake. Like, why would you go to something that's fake?
Mm.
But now it's like, the way that I always kind of present it to people is I go, well, you go and watch every Marvel movie that comes out, right? And they go, yeah. And I go, well, we're giving you that. We have our own universe that you're a part of once you're there in the audience. And before the show and after the show, you're out of that universe. You're in reality.
Yep.
But when you're there for the show, just pretend you're sitting there to watch the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and that's what you're invested in.
Yeah.
So know what it is, and people, like, they know it's predetermined. They know all these kind of like realities of pro wrestling. But because of how good it's gotten as well, they're just like, well, I know that shit is fake, but it's so fucking good. It's
entertaining as hell.
Yeah, exactly. And especially when they come to an event live in person, it's very different to watch it on TV versus being in the audience.
Yeah.
It's very captivating, and it is unlike anything else that you can experience, especially when you go to a really good show. So I think it is becoming more acceptable to go, look, I know what it is, but I still love it anyway.
Yeah.
And it's still great. And to be honest, I'm glad you touched on it. It is very dangerous. Mm. I see most of the injuries from training, which is like, for some people, they wouldn't think that's the case. But when you're a wrestler in training, learning a lot of the moves, that's where shit goes wrong so often. I've seen broken backs, broken legs, broken ankles, broken wrists, broken pretty much everything, multiple concussions from some of the simple stuff too. And for me personally, I take some pretty high risk shit in the ring. But it's always the small movements that, to the untrained eye like yourself, you might see and think it's just a simple small hit or small slam. But actually, if you were, say, the referee in the ring, you would hear me go, oh, fuck, that fucking hurt, like shit.
Yeah.
Just because I felt awkwardly in one way. And that's the stuff that'll linger with me for 2, 3, 4 weeks. And I'm like, far out. If I just did this or did that, I would have been fine. But I was lazy with it, or something happened that I wasn't prepared for, and now I've got a bung shoulder for 6 weeks.
See, I saw a video of you like spearing out of the ring, doing a flip and landing on some dude. And I'm thinking, like, that's such a hectic move. But, like, if you're doing it a million times, there are times when it, like, could easily go wrong, right?
Yeah, 100%. With that one specifically, there have been times where I've caught my feet on the ropes and I actually just land head first on the ground. So I've miscalculated my projection.
Right. So even if you're a pro, like, you know, there's just such small margin for error.
Exactly. And the common one that happens too is if I'm wrestling at an event that has guardrails or barriers, my legs get axed on that dive every time. So I might get caught well and truly by the other guy, but sometimes they're real bad with catching me on that. And what happens is, like, my calves or my hamstrings just go whack. And I'm sitting there and I just don't move for about 30 seconds and my head's going, fuck, I got to keep going. Mm. And I know I'm going to have bruises somewhere, but it's like, okay, muster up the strength, get up and go for it. Luckily, it's not my head. It's not my neck. I can still go. Let's go on.
Yeah. Do you think the movie The Wrestler was good for wrestling overall? Because when I see that, I was just like, I found it quite, it was so gritty and kind of, I guess, open your eyes about what it looked like behind the scenes, but just how much these guys just sacrifice their bodies just for the love of the crowd.
Yeah, right? Mickey Rourke did a great job in that role.
Obviously there's a lot of steroid, drug abuse, that kind of stuff that's in that. I don't know how much of that you're seeing on a day-to-day basis. But in terms of just the amount of just punishment these guys do just for the love of a crowd, I was just like, it's unfair to say wrestling's fake when you just look at, like, the – what these guys are doing for their passion, for entertainment.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I mean, the rock star lifestyle of pro wrestling has kind of faded away into obscurity. It is still present, but it's on a more minimal scale than it was, say, the 80s, the 90s, the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Whereas now, you get, it's funny, wrestling's very much a place for the introverts is what I found.
That's interesting.
So when I first started, it was very much like you'd do a show and then you'd want to go to the pub afterwards and have a few beers and whatever else. But now it's like with the younger kids that are around me, like, I might just want to catch up with them on a Saturday and just have a few drinks. Mm. But they're all like, no, we're going to go play Nintendo Switch and all hang out. And I'm like, that's cool. I'm into that as well. So that's awesome. I actually like that because my body will feel less shit the next day afterwards.
Yeah.
But no, The Wrestler definitely did shine a positive light as well as, like, a negative. It did show some of the dark stuff as well.
Yeah.
But I think they did such a good job of, like, making it so reality based, whereas previous wrestling films were very eccentric and over the top. Whereas this one really did show you what it's like, especially for someone that's kind of been doing it for so long past their prime and still hanging on to this one thing that they've known. And that's their bread and butter. That's the only thing that they can do. And, you know, it's a really sad movie, but yeah, it is really good for us in the industry to go, hey, watch this. And that gives you a little bit of insight to what we do on a regular basis.
I'd like to talk about that pathway from when you were working a full-time job while also wrestling and I guess the friction there, because you said you were working a job for what, 6 or 7 years?
6 years, yeah.
What was the job?
So I was working for a courier company.
Yeah.
They were basically the direct competitor for Australia Post across Australia. Yeah. And I started, like, entry level, just working in one of the stores, and then I kind of bounced around from store to store. I was working in the corporate field.
And they knew that you were wrestling.
Yeah, from day one. And that's usually it was like my easy way to get a job, because I'd always put it on my resume. So people would go, look, we might not give him the job, but we want to pull him in for an interview to be like, pro wrestler, what the fuck?
Yeah,
so okay. I would always use that as, like, an in.
Good novelty factor, right?
Yeah. And it always worked. I'd always get the job. There was very few I got turned away from.
I'm going to add that to my resume.
And just look, what are they going to do? Just put a profile up on the web, on the internet, and people will believe you. So it's fine. You look like a wrestler too, Hannah. So you'll be fine. But yeah, so I started there in, what was it, late 2012, and just kind of worked my way up through the ranks. And then I got to a point where I was an area manager for the corporate business. So I was going from Queensland to Adelaide to Melbourne to all over New South Wales, managing other stores. I had no position to be in that position at my age. I was still in my 20s.
Yeah.
And I was telling people in their 50s and 60s how to run their business. So I felt really awkward about it. But yeah, they were really supportive with wrestling up until they weren't.
Yeah.
And I actually got my first tour with New Japan Pro Wrestling whilst working at that job.
Yeah.
Late 2018. And I told them, look, this is the biggest opportunity I could get. New Japan's basically the same level as WWE, but in that part of the world.
Yeah.
So if I don't take this, that's me, you know, putting my dream to the side. And they were like, cool, go and do it. I did it. And then I started building that relationship. And then from there, I had to put more time off for, I think it was like early 2019.
Yeah.
My boss pulled me in. He was like, hey, look, we've got your time off request, but you know, we need you here. And I was like, oh, well, you know, I can do it. No pay. Don't worry about it. I know I don't have any more annual leave. And they're like, no. It's not about you not having the leave. We don't care about that. We just need you to be here at work.
Yeah.
And I was like, shit. Okay. Had to give them an answer like the next day, came in the next day, spoke to my wife, and she was like, look, if this is what we need to do, this is what we need to do. Gave them my notice. And then the next day, it was really funny. The next day we had like a team meeting for the team I was in, which was planning out the whole year. And I'm like, I've given them 4 weeks notice. Why do I need to go to this team meeting? It seems redundant at this point.
Yeah.
They opened the day by saying, Rob's leaving us. He's going to go on and do other things. You know, thanks for all the time. Sweet. And then as I leave that meeting at about 4 p.m., I get a text and it's like, hey, call me. And I'm like, shit, this is one of the guys in Japan. Mm. And I call him. I stop in at like a parking lot in Liverpool. And yeah, they offered me a full-time gig with New Japan Pro Wrestling. And I called my wife and she was just like, you're joking. I'm like, no, I'm not joking. I'm not trying to make you feel better about me quitting my job that I've had for 6 years. This is what's happening.
And it's enough of an offer from New Japan Pro Wrestling to make a living from wrestling.
100%. It was a full-time contract. So it was equal to, if not greater than what I was making in this other job.
But
so
get,
I was like,
but you get to live your dream.
Exactly. Mm. I get to commit full time to pro wrestling. And I mean, I was already committing to it. So like work breaks, lunch breaks, all that sort of stuff. I'd be like skipping out to the gym and I'd have an hour for a lunch break, but I'd be like, oh, maybe I can get an hour 15.
Were you scared for a second when you quit?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
I had literally signed up to be an Uber Eats driver. Mm. And I was like, if this is what I have to do to make ends meet until I can make it in pro wrestling or at least commit myself to pro wrestling full time for 6 months,
yeah,
then I'll deliver drunk Maccas to people as much as I need to.
Hearing you speak like that, is you're thinking your mindset was not I'm going to do this in case I can become a professional wrestler. It was I'm doing this until – like it sounds like you had in your mind this is 100% belief that it was going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I knew I'd created that relationship with New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Yeah.
And I knew I'd done well on my first tour. They were bringing me in for another shot. So I was like, sweet. There's nothing guaranteed at that point. So I was like, I'll just be ready for the call whenever it comes. And then I had a few opportunities in the States coming up in, I think it was April of 2019. So I was like, let's just have a proper crack and like try and make a name for myself. And whoever it is, whether it's, you know, a WWE or an AEW or a New Japan, like if someone comes in with an offer, then that's me set. So that's pretty much all I was setting as a goal and just trying to attain it any way I could at that point. Because I'd never really, except for when I first started in 2008 and was just kind of a burgeoning wrestler in training, I'd never really committed myself that much to it without having some sort of job on the side that was, you know, basically financing my pro wrestling passion.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to kind of give myself that, hey, let's have a go. Let's have a red hot crack and actually try and make it. And, you know, I was just very lucky how those 24 hours played out.
How did you feel when you got the phone call and said you're on the team, you're joining New Japan?
Well, when I got the text, it was so unknown what the context of the call was going to be that I thought I had fucked something up on my first tour and they were telling me not to come in February.
Oh.
So I was scared out of my mind that I had done something wrong or said something wrong. Mm. And then like the person that I was speaking to on the phone just was like, nope, so this is the deal. We want to offer you a contract. This is what it's going to be. And I was just like, I heard it all, but it was like my brain went into white noise after they offered me the contract.
Hard to take it all in.
Yeah. And then I was just, yes, 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 okay, hung up. And then I just sat there for 5 minutes just going, what the fuck just happened? And then made the call to my wife and she was ecstatic because especially I think she was panicking more than I was 24 hours prior when I was like, look, I have to quit. She's always been super supportive, but she was also like, fuck, like I'm going to have to be the breadwinner now. And I was like, lucky it didn't happen that way.
What's your wife's name?
Christine.
Christine, where'd you meet her?
She actually came to a wrestling show.
I was hoping you were going to say something like that.
Back in Liverpool in 2011, she was dragged kicking and screaming by someone that used to be a referee for us. And they're high school friends. So they hadn't caught up for a while. And he's like, look, I'll come to this birthday party you want to go to, but you got to come to the wrestling with me before. And she's like, fine. And then he put in a good word for me and we met up on Facebook, started talking, and then, yeah.
Wow.
Hit it off from there.
I was like, please tell me that this was a story involving you guys meeting during wrestling.
That's, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, cool. So, I mean, does she travel with you when you're going to your matches or no?
She has before. Yeah. Not so much now, just because she's been with me for the long run. We've been together for over 10 years now.
Yeah.
Married for almost 5. So she's kind of seen the lows and she's seen the highs. And I think the highest point for us was we recently bought our first home last year and pretty much solely off my wrestling contract. So. Oh, amazing. If I didn't have that, we wouldn't be in the position we're in, and we're very fortunate and lucky for it.
Buying a home from money made from living your dream every day. That's pretty sick, man.
Buying a home in Sydney too, which is pretty much impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, we went to 50 open homes, and the joke was we had been to so many, people were offering like ridiculous amounts over the asking price. And I said, hey, babe, all we need is for one person to go, are you Robbie Eagles? Mm. And that pretty much happened at the open home we went to. He was like, oh, yeah, I took my young mate to the wrestling one time. And I go, was that the Camden Civic Center? He goes, yeah. And then we go back to the office to sign the contract. And he like goes through like 7 years of photos on his phone. And he goes, here's my young mate. And it's his son, the agent's son, with a bunch of the wrestlers that I trained. And I go, I was on that show, sir. And he's like, oh, amazing.
Wow. Just need a little bit of star power to grease the deal.
Yep. I mean, I was waiting for it. And it all, my life's really weird. I feel like every time these things happen, it's literally the universe and the stars aligning, and shit just happens for me at the bleakest hour too. So
I think good things start to happen when you put in the work though, you know?
I agree.
I don't think it just happens for no reason. I think you've put yourself in a position for these opportunities to happen, and that feels pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very happy with where my life is, and I thank all of it to professional wrestling. Like, I wouldn't have met Christine if I wasn't a wrestler. I wouldn't own the home that I own now if I wasn't a wrestler.
Yeah.
And, you know, even the bond that I have with my family is stronger because of wrestling. Like, my sister watched it when we were growing up. Her husband, my brother-in-law, actually, we started training on the same day because he had the same aspirations to be a wrestler. It just didn't work out for him just through some injuries and stuff early on, but we're still just as close, if not closer than we were.
So I wanted to just touch on that bit about, the putting in the same performance, whether it's a big gig or a small gig, because I mean, if I was a talent scout, for wrestling or for anything else, I would want to go see performers at the smaller gigs, right? Just because it seems like that's the little things, right? You want to see a guy who's, just because it's a smaller gig, is not just phoning it in, right? There must be wrestlers who don't have that same level of passion or interest when it's a smaller gig, when there's only a handful of people in the audience.
Oh, yeah, right? Definitely. And I think it's the thing with the smaller gigs is they're more nerve-wracking than the bigger ones.
Why is that?
Because it's more intimate. Mm. You can literally, like, if you're in front of 50 people, you can hear each person in the room and like what their thoughts are. It's almost telekinetic.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I've wrestled in places like the Tokyo Dome, which can fit, when I've wrestled there for the first time, is like 35,000 people.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you're not wrestling in front of anyone because it's so big and the acoustics just go out, and like you'll do something and the reaction takes like a 5 second delay to come into you in the ring. So it's almost like, oh, I'm just going to go about my business and like, I'm sure it's fine. But the one where it's like a room of 50 people, that's really important, because if you can connect and get each person in the room, and like if you find the one person that's sitting on their hands and you can get them clapping and cheering by the end of it, you know you've done your job, because you've gone, that person wasn't into this whole show, but I've made them react to something, job well done. Definitely that's where the little things come to light. If you're not nailing those little in-between moments or the little techniques that you think you can overlook in the bigger matches and the bigger shows, that's really important. And yeah, that's definitely where the talent scouts can come in and go, how do I know a guy is a guy, or how do I know this girl is like the best one in her division kind of thing. You got to go to those shows and see them in action in that setting. And, you know, it's the same as training. If you can turn it on at training, and like us as the peers, we're the hardest audience to get behind because we know how it all works.
Yeah.
So then if someone catches me off guard as a coach when we're training in their performance and like does something that makes me naturally react, I go, they've got it. So yeah, that's what you're looking for.
That sounds like an open mic comedy gig, because you're sitting there with a whole bunch of comics that you perform with all the time. They know all your jokes. So if you can get them to laugh, you're like, okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's exactly, I mean, that's probably the most relatable thing I could say.
Yeah. That's really funny. What else did I want to talk to you about? I think, what is it like for you as a coach to try and train guys? Are there guys that you come across that you just like are untrainable, or that they're just not getting it? Or are there guys that you, what's the skill in being a coach to these guys?
I guess it's finding different ways to come across to them. Like, yeah. So not everyone learns in the same spaces. So yeah. You got to find ways to communicate different things to different people. There definitely are, I think for me, I coach the advanced classes.
Yeah.
So pretty much the people that are on the cusp of becoming a wrestler, like they're really close to having their first match, or those that are already performing, that's pretty much the main people I coach. For years, I coached your beginners to your intermediates, and I kind of just was done with that. I couldn't handle it anymore. But every now and then I'll step into some of those classes and just see how those kids are going. But there definitely are people that like you kind of realize, hey, wrestling is not for them. Maybe it's the physical aspect. Maybe it's just they don't know how to carry their body correctly and like be safe for themselves. And it's a pretty disheartening thing to like have a conversation with someone about, especially if, you know, a lot of them come in, my dream is to be a pro wrestler. I want to get to WrestleMania, whatever it is. And then you've got to kind of bring that reality to them and go, I think based on you training here for 2 years and you're kind of at the same level, it might not be for you, but that doesn't mean that you're out of pro wrestling. You just got to find another avenue for them. They might be better suited to be a referee, which is still an on-stage performer. Yeah. They may have a great voice. So they're the ring announcer that introduces the wrestlers for the matches, and they're basically the MC for the show. Or they could be a commentator that calls matches. There's so many different positions that they could fulfill.
Yeah.
It just might not be where their aspiration was.
So there's a lot of roles in the wrestling family.
Right? Yeah, definitely. From production to on stage, like there's so many different things that you could fulfill. Wrestling managers is something that hasn't been present for the longest time, but it's starting to have a resurgence. So if you find you've got, you know, a tag team or even an individual that's not the best talker, they can't cut a promo, then you need someone to do that for them, and that's where a wrestling manager can come in. So if you've got someone that's really eccentric, has this character and presence, but, you know, they can't run the ropes to save their life, or they can't, you know, throw a hit that looks convincing, then you go, well, maybe this is the direction we can steer you towards.
It sounds like it's easier to fix if someone has the technical skills but they're not huge at, like, the performance piece. That's easier to fix than vice versa.
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's definitely easier to pick up.
Yeah. I mean, how do you help someone if you think that they're really strong technically, but they're just, they don't have the performance presence, that they're not creating a strong enough character in the ring?
It's usually from actually just doing it. So like almost, you know, on the job training, you go, okay, you push them out into the deep end and go, you're in the next show, you're in the opening match, have a crack.
Yeah.
And then when they come back and they go, yeah, the crowd was flat, you go, well, it's because of this, this, and this. Everything you hit was perfect, but you didn't give any emotion behind any of it. So there's nothing for the audience to connect to, whether you're, you know, on the negative or positive side of, you know, the villain or the hero. So you just make them learn that way. Most people that I deal with are pretty good at self-identifying these issues.
Yeah.
It's just
that
when
that helps.
Yeah. Right. And the self-assessment is what gets you to where you want to go. Like if you want to make it here, then self-assessing after each performance is what's going to get you there. But if you're coming back from what I would think is a pretty average performance going, fuck yeah, man, that was awesome, we were so good, then you're like,
There are people like that though, aren't there?
Yeah, 100%.
A bit deluded.
Yeah. So, we see it a lot. We try not to surround ourselves, like the group that I'm involved with, we don't surround ourselves with those kind of people because it means they're pretty happy with average.
Yeah.
And we're always trying to exceed that. So yeah, we're very lucky with the group that we've kind of maintained.
What's the smallest audience that you ever had?
Oh man, There's many. My second ever match was in our training facility in Minto near Campbelltown. Mm. And it's an industrial warehouse and it was in front of two people. Mm. But I have wrestled in a Bunnings parking lot in Narellan to promote a show that we were having in Camden a couple of weeks later. And there was not a single person that came specifically to watch us, to the point where I was wrestling. Mm. And one of the fellow wrestlers, because we all play many roles, we wear different hats depending on the day. One of my fellow wrestlers was behind the camera, and because there was no one and we were kind of like, look, it is what it is, he goes, hey, pay attention to the car, pay attention to the car. And a wrestling trope for you is, come on, baby, as a good guy is always going to get like a, yeah. So I hit a come on, baby, to the car. It was just driving past, and I got a bip, bip, and I was like, yeah, let's go.
That'll do.
Highlight of my day.
So it was just people walking past at Bunnings, just watching for a minute.
They were more invested in the sausage snags than they were the wrestling ring in the car park. So,
I mean, who can blame them? The sausage is pretty great.
We should have had the sausage sizzle tent in the ring.
Right. Yeah. Or just like right next to it.
Yeah, it was actually our entryway. So our stage to walk from was we would just crouch down behind the tent and then go, yay, I'm doing my entrance. Follow me along.
So you've done the micro gigs. And now tell me about the biggest audience you've had.
Probably the Tokyo Dome, like I mentioned earlier, 35,000 people. Mm. I, at that stage, was on the pre-show, so it was kind of like, it was aired, but it was not the main attraction show, so it was for people that came early, but it was still very surreal. It was incredible to be there. That was right before the pandemic hit in early 2020, and unfortunately, that was supposed to be the year where my career in Japan was really going to take off, and it kind of plummeted because I got locked out of the country for a while.
Yeah, of course.
But, man, there was so many Aussies that had come over because New Japan's quite popular in the West. And I could, like, pick out faces and names from the audience and people that I met up with over the weekend leading into it. And to know that I was wrestling in front of 35,000 people, like, I was scared shitless before going out there. But then once I was there, I was like, this is where I was always meant to be.
Holy shit.
It was, like, a really surreal moment.
And how did it feel afterwards?
It felt great. I actually had to do kind of three matches in one because we did what's called a gauntlet. So it's a trios tag match. We went in as the first team, and if you win, you stay in and the next team comes out until the final team. So there was six teams in the whole thing. It's like a mini tournament that just runs like one whole long match. So we beat the first team, we beat the second team, and we just went down to the third team, who then went on to, I think there was the fifth team at the end of it, and they ended up fighting for the title at the end. So we're really close to winning the whole damn thing. But for me, it was like a feather in my cap to go, hey, I'm still new in this company and they're letting me be a part of the winning team for the first like two matches of this five match kind of series.
Yeah.
It was really important, especially as an Australian, because there wasn't really any representation from Australians in New Japan before I came along.
What is the mix? Is it mostly Asian countries?
It's predominantly Japanese,
yeah.
But we are really multicultural in New Japan. There's a couple of people from England. Yeah. There's a lot of people from the States. There's actually, before I came along, there was more New Zealand representation in New Japan than there was Australia.
Yeah.
And wow. I was like, fuck, I got to make that right. I got to change that because I can't let these Kiwis get one over us.
So how many Aussies are in the mix now?
There's myself, Mikey Nichols, Shane Haste, Jonah. That's pretty much it at the moment, but there is going to be more coming, especially with New Japan Tamashii, which is the Oceanic brand that's going to be starting in November.
What's it like as an Aussie wrestler in Japan against the Japanese? Do they still get behind you?
Yeah, I surprisingly have a pretty strong fan base over there, which you'd think the foreigners would be harder for them to kind of get behind. They'd be more behind the locals, but it's just wrestling, and it's people that connect with you. And I think I've just found my way to connect with an audience no matter where I am, whether it's in the States, the UK, Japan. I most recently went to Mexico, got Mexican COVID while I was there, which was pretty fucking rough.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's different, but it's very much the same. So you just kind of go, okay, like we were talking about earlier, you try one thing. If it hits or misses, then you either continue or change, and then you keep going from there until you find what's working, and that's your niche and you stick to it.
Now, tell me if this is a question which is, trade secrets or something that you can't reveal, but I was interested in if the results are of a wrestling match are predetermined, how do you determine who's going to win? Who gets the right to win?
It's usually given to you as an instruction.
Yeah.
So someone that has the pencil, as we like to say, makes the decisions.
Yeah.
You can have, there is a lot of creative input in what we do. But at the end of the day, your creative input might still not be the way that you want it to go. And you just got to roll with that.
Is it about like earning your stripes or is it about popularity? I mean, what are the factors behind it?
It's kind of everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, how long have you been in it? There's very much a thing, especially in Japan, and it's kind of around the world, really. If you're a rookie wrestler, like you're a debutante,
yeah.
It's not believable that you come in and just start winning straight away.
Totally.
Because you're just learning. You're still learning. Like, you're brand new. You could be 6'5", but it doesn't mean that you're the best. Like, you don't know all the techniques yet. So I think that's very much like a cultural thing that carries out across most wrestling. Mm. Like, it's very rare now that you have someone that's like, oh, he's only been wrestling 6 months. He's going to be the best. And he just smashes through the competition. Like, say, like Goldberg and WCW did.
Right. Yeah. So I remember I was like back when I was obsessed with wrestling, right? When he had this, he came out of nowhere and he had this huge hot streak, right?
They're very rare these days. I think it's just because of that believability.
But is it, but I mean, for that, I mean, he came out of like being a professional footballer, I think. And so he already had some kind of like celebrity status maybe behind him. I thought maybe that because he had this kind of persona or gravitas around him, maybe there was a hype that helped to be a factor.
I think
maybe?
That does factor in for sure. It would be interesting to have, like, I'd love to have someone, I don't know, like very rarely it happens, but let's say an ex-NRL player wants to have a crack at wrestling.
Yeah.
I'd love to train that person and see how they go. And like, you know, would people believe that they're supposed to just start flogging people right from the get-go because they've been smashing people on the field for 10 plus years or whatever it is. Like, I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Much like if you had someone come from, usually the transition is wrestling to MMA, but if you do it the other way around, you've got that legitimate sports background in MMA. And if they came to pro wrestling, you go, oh, this guy's legit. So it kind of makes sense that he's just going to be a killer straight away as well.
I saw in research for this, I saw an interview with Ric Flair talking about just all these big NFL players that tried to get into wrestling, but they just didn't make the cut, right? Yeah. And so I think you can't just be a massive professional athlete and think that, like, you can just come into wrestling and be good at it, right? It's a very unique skill set, not only in terms of the moves but also the showmanship, all these factors that come into play that make a great wrestler. So, I mean, have you come across any guys like that in Australia that have come from that have already had some kind of professional athlete experience or celebrity status and come into wrestling and tried it?
I guess the only person that I can kind of think of that I don't have a direct relationship with, but peers of mine that are now in WWE have a relationship with him would be Daniel Vido.
Right. Yeah. So he used to play for the Canberra Raiders, right?
And I think he was at the Broncos kind of right before he kind of made the transition. Yeah. And I just remember being a bit annoyed because I read an article in one of the newspapers that was like, Daniel Vido is going to have a crack at WWE and pro wrestling. And like the quote was like, yeah, I never thought about, you know, doing wrestling, but someone said I could make a lot of money, so I thought I'd give it a go. And for me in 2016,
that'd piss you off.
I was so insulted because I'm like, I've been working so fucking hard to try and make it somewhere. And then just because you played rugby for a minute or whatever it is, you get this opportunity. But he's doing quite well over there now. He's been training and learning and he's created his own character and he's got his own following there. And like, he's not phoned it in. He's actually had a go. So good on him for doing that.
Right. So he might have just been misquoted or misunderstood because, you know, when you hear that, it sounds like he's getting into it for the wrong reason.
Yeah.
But you can't fake that once you're in the ring all the time. You need to have, as you said before, that genuine X factor and also the technical skills behind it. So it seems like he is doing well in that regard.
Yeah, I think so. And on like a personal level, I do remember we had a kid come train with us almost 10 years ago, and he was an ex-rugby player, not of like a high level, like kind of just high school and some grade comps and stuff like that. But he was so naturally talented. He was an Islander as well, just brick shit house, real tall, super athletic, picked everything up straight away. And I think he actually was on the cusp of getting signed because I did a WWE tryout in 2014 in Melbourne with like a group of 40 of us. And Kenny, the kid that I helped train, he got invited to do it. And I'm like, Kenny, you've been training for 6 months. Like, how are you getting this opportunity? And then I looked at him up and down and I went, oh, yeah, right, fair enough. And he was pretty much close to being a WWE wrestler at that point. So
you were involved with the tryouts as well?
Yes, like I was actually trying out.
Yeah.
But it's a funny story that I tell a lot of people because I was recommended by other people that had done tryouts previously.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like they put my name forward and they kept putting, give Robbie a tryout, give Robbie a tryout. And the WWE were like, fine, we're not interested in him. He's too short and we think he sucks, but we'll let him come anyway. And I literally saw that in like the email that I was CC'd in. And I'm like, oh, sweet. Fuck. This is going to be a great tryout for me. And I like did the best I could.
How does it make you feel when you get that?
I was just like, oh, well, at least I'm doing one, I guess. And I just tried to impress as much as possible, but I was like stepping on eggshells. I wanted to make sure that I didn't like piss anyone off. I didn't want to say the wrong thing. So I was probably more, held back than I should have been.
Subdued.
Yeah. I look back at it and I was like, fuck, like they would have remembered me better if I just like got naked and started whipping my dick out or something. Like I should have done something more memorable than what I did that weekend.
Just something really over the top.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's pretty harsh when you think that they've already got this preconceived notion of you before you even go to the fucking tryout.
Yeah. Yeah. But it all came full circle in, they had a big show at the MCG in 2018 and I was doing local gigs the night before and we did like a special breakfast kind of morning show before everyone went off to the MCG that night. And I got a really late invite to attend. And it was from one of the people that was running the tryout in 2014. And he was like, I got to meet him again. He was like, hey, Robbie, nice to see you. And at this point I was going to do my first tour with New Japan. It just hadn't been announced yet.
Yep.
And so I was kind of smug coming into that confrontation going, oh, it's interested that like, it's funny that you're interested in me now, or have some sort of like feeling of, oh, we should bring Robbie along. He did really well last night. Like he's a star here in Australia.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, fuck you. I'm not going to your company ever anymore. That's not my path.
Well, I mean, yeah. Do you think that when you get that like validation from being with New Japan that they must look at that and think, fuck, did we make a mistake here?
I hope so.
Yeah.
I definitely hope so.
Like, fuck you guys.
Yeah. In 2014, maybe I was uninteresting and not something that you were looking for, but you know, I've come into my own and that's what experience and years does for you. So, and I felt it back then in 2014, I still had the same sort of belief in myself that I do now and in 2018. So I'm just like, I very much had that attitude of, when I went to the MCG, I was just sitting there going, well, fuck this. I don't give a shit about being here because I'm going to another company.
Yeah. Do you have any lingering injuries or like that stay with you now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, multiple concussions.
I see all these videos of like, how are these guys still walking, you know?
I've got a recent scar over my eye here that was from maybe 3 months ago from a match in Melbourne.
Yeah, what hit you?
A flying chair. Which I've been hit with multiple times.
Yeah, this one split your head open.
This one just got me in the wrong spot. Yeah. So, and it was quite funny because the two people ringside, one taking photos and one filming the match, are good friends of mine. I've been to one of their weddings, hung out a bunch, and they know my wife quite well. So I'm in the ring, I'm doing the performance, the audience has none the wiser on what's going on, and I've just got this huge cut over my eyebrow, I'm pissing out blood, and I'm just turning to them going, Christine's going to be so mad.
Yeah.
She was pretty mad.
What does she say? I was going to say, what does she say when you come home with just a new injury?
Yeah, I made sure to call her because I always like message her after every match. Like I message her before and then I message her after.
She must get worried, right?
Sometimes. And this is what happened was, I hadn't messaged her after for quite a while. I was holding off on it because I was like, shit, how do I tell her? And then she was out having a girl's night and she had a few drinks. So it was good for me that she did. Because then when I was like, she was like, hey, are you okay?
Just softened the blow.
I just FaceTimed her and I was like, hey. And then I revealed that I had like all this bandaging and blood and I was sitting out of Royal Melbourne Hospital. And I was like, I had a little bit of a boo-boo. And she goes, you're going to Mexico in 3 days. What's wrong with you? And I'm like, shit happens. Shit's gone sideways.
Yeah.
So literally.
What other injuries have you had?
I've had torn ligaments in my ankle. I've had, nerve damage and pulled muscles in like my traps and my neck. I think the major one was a week before I had an IWGP junior title match in Festival Hall in Melbourne. I actually tore my MCL. On another show.
Yeah, fuck.
And then I had about 5 days to rehab it and be ready for this match because it was like I couldn't tell New Japan I'm injured before like the biggest match they're putting me in Australia as well, which is very rare for them to come here. And I was like, fuck, I just got to do whatever I can. I got a brace. I went to physio almost every day and I just kind of gritted my teeth and got through it. But like, I could barely walk. So that was not fun.
Man, like just, it's crazy just the amount you put your body on the line just for, I mean, you love doing it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you must have seen some guys that do this all the time that just have injuries that they can't kind of come back from.
There's definitely people that are like more injury prone than others and they're just unlucky.
Yeah.
And then there's, yeah, I've seen.
Like you, I consider you probably, you're durable, right?
I like to think so. I like to think so. Lots of people used to call me Rubberneck Robbie because like my neck was invincible.
Yeah.
Not so much now. There's definitely times where I feel like I'm being held up by tape. But I found ways to, you know, negate the injuries or do risk assessment about what I'm doing. But I also take recovery very seriously. So
yeah,
I have my own hot tub at home and it's not for fun. It's literally for recovery. So I don't sit there going, oh, I'm going to have a beer and just enjoy this. I sit there going, my body feels like shit. I need this. But that's the investment that I've made into my recovery.
You see these pro wrestlers that are still wrestling where they're fucking fossils, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking, like, as long as you don't have any, like, serious injuries that cause, like, disability, like, how long could you soldier on doing this?
Well, one of my tag partners in Japan is Tiger Mask, and he just turned 53,
right.
I believe, and he's been wrestling since, you know, arguably – since like 18, 19.
When would you keep going till? Until you like physically couldn't stand to do it anymore? Or do you have an end date in mind?
Yeah, that's kind of like a, I think with wrestlers of my generation, it's more of a reality. Like the previous generation, like your Ric Flairs and your Hulk Hogan's, they went until the wheels fell off.
Yeah.
Whereas I think a lot of us now are a bit smarter about that because we go, we see, especially when you meet those guys now, and I've met Ric Flair and I've seen how he moves and how he talks and walks and everything. And I'm kind of like, shit, like I want to be in better nick at that age than he is. And what can I do to prevent that? Obviously our schedules are completely different. Like he was wrestling every fucking day for years and years and years. It was very different. But
the passion's the same. It seems like it's like an addiction, right? Like an addiction to the performance. Right?
Yeah.
You've been doing this for so many years and you love doing it. So I imagine the idea of stopping it would be terrifying to me.
Right? It really is. But I think that's why I get like part of my enjoyment is from the training aspect.
Yeah.
So okay. I'm actually sometimes more proud of someone else's performance, knowing that I had a hand in getting them to that level than my own. And my match could arguably be better on the night. But I'm just like, no, I'm more proud of these boys or these girls for doing that because I know where they started and like to see them come to this point is just incredible. And I know I had a hand in it.
I think that's an important part is having some kind of transition plan where you can still be involved in the sport that you love, right?
Yeah.
Without it having to be in the ring yourself. Because you see all these sad stories of like professional rugby league players, rugby union players that when they stop playing, and they suddenly aren't part of this network anymore, that their life starts to fall apart because they're just part of this huge community and this huge family. And then suddenly they're out on their own and they're just not equipped for it, right? And so it sounds very similar with the wrestling family in that, you might have the mindset of, okay, I'm too battered and bruised to wrestle anymore. But I'm just moving to the next natural progression of where I fit within this.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I'm always forward thinking of is like, okay, so even if it gets to a point where maybe my interest level in coaching goes down, what else can I do? But there's so many things behind the scenes that puts a wrestling show together.
Yeah.
That, you know, I've always been, there was a point in time where I was more like a floor manager for a lot of the events. And then I kind of let that go to other people because it was too stressful for me to deal with.
Yeah.
But because I've been so involved in it from, you know, when we load the ring on the truck to loading it back at the facility at the end of the night at 2 a.m. after we're done, that I feel like I could kind of help out in any sort of way. And now I'm more of an advisory. I give advice based on, okay, so I've just come back from a tour in Japan. What were they doing that we can incorporate here to help grow Australian wrestling? And I go, well, we should do this, this, and this.
What are some of those things?
It's like simple things like marketing. It could be the way that they present the actual show from start to finish. And it's like really subtle details as well. Like one of the things that we brought into PWA was very much like boxing, you have a red and blue corner, right?
Yeah.
So in Japan, that's very prevalent. So you've got two white corners, a red and blue corner. So we brought that into PWA, and our color scheme is green and black. So we have a green corner and a black corner to be a little bit different and nuanced. But it took ages for me to get the wrestlers to line up in the black corner and the green corner. I kept seeing them line up in the two white corners, and I'm like, no, that's not right. You're not presenting it correctly. So it's just like little subtle nuances that can just make the presentation feel different and almost more sports-like.
Yeah.
Because the more that we can convince people that it is real,
yep,
then the more we can continue to captivate more audiences.
Yeah. I saw an interview where you were talking about just the importance of being having relationships in the dressing room. I imagine, you know, that's an interesting factor, is just some people have good relationships with other wrestlers. Sometimes it's bad. What's it like to I don't know if you have any, like, or have had any, like, personal beefs with someone that you've had to end up in the ring with, but what's it like when you, like, have a – genuine dislike for the person that you're wrestling with?
It can be confronting, and it is one of those, like, moments where you kind of have to, you know, talk to yourself about how you're going to go about this.
Yeah. Imagine in those situations it's very easy for things to escalate,
mm-hmm,
just in terms of the performance, like, wow, he's, like, really not pulling those punches. He's whacking me really, really hard.
Yeah, I think the story that I can think of for me personally is – I kind of had a falling out with a friend of mine in a match.
Yeah.
He thought that I was intentionally trying to hurt him.
Mm.
So we got to, like, our words got really heated afterwards, and I was explaining to him that I was never trying to hurt him. You know, I was just trying to perform, but he got caught off guard by something I did.
Mm.
And then we had to wrestle in a tag team match, like, a month or two later. And we were still kind of not friendly.
Yeah.
But then we had this awesome match that just, like, went perfectly. The crowd was unreal for it. And
so it kind of brought you guys back together?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was, like, voted match of the night, and it was, like, a featured match for that company for the year and stuff. And so we went, look, fuck it. We kind of just looked at each other afterwards and we're like, look, I'm sorry for the bullshit from 2 months ago. Let's just move on and forget about it. And I've been lucky that that's pretty much been the only time I've fallen into that position. But there's definitely been times that I've had to mediate situations between other people.
So, and what's that called? Like, if someone in a wrestling match whacks someone way harder than expected, was it called receipts? Is that?
So it's probably referred to as them being stiff,
yeah,
which means it's harder than you anticipate. Yeah. And then the receipt is when you give them one back.
Yeah.
So if you cop one hard and you go, okay, here's the next one, and it's just as hard, yeah, it's a receipt.
Yeah.
And 9 times out of 10, the person goes, oh, okay, my bad. And then we go on with the performance.
Yeah.
But that 10th time, yeah, someone goes, oh, well, fuck you, and goes even harder for the next one.
Wow.
And then shit can
really
escalate and gets bad.
Yeah. I mean, have you ever seen that where wrestling has suddenly, like, escalated into, like, a proper brawl? Or
never in person.
Yeah.
But there's definitely times that I've seen it on tape, on DVD, and on the internet.
Yeah.
It's always very, like, awkward. So I try not to put anyone in that position.
Chaotic. I mean, probably be pretty entertaining for the crowd, but
I feel like sometimes the crowd can read the awkwardness. So it's entertaining for the first 5 to 10 seconds, and then they go, oh, this isn't right. I shouldn't be here for this.
This is, yeah. So what's it like? Another thing I wanted to ask you about is all these people that come to wrestling, either in Japan or Australia, what is it that you think is about – what is it about wrestling that they love so much? What is it about seeing you guys perform, about the characters, the larger-than-life characters, and the performances and the wrestling that makes these guys – because there's people that are just obsessed with this shit, right? You just have these huge cult followings. What is it that you're tapping into that makes people just absolutely love this?
It's different country to country. There's lots of cultural differences.
Yeah.
Like in Japan, it's more about the spirit of the fighter. They call it, like, fighting spirit.
Yeah.
And what they actually react stronger for is the match continuing. So as you are getting pinned and you kick out of, like, another big move, you actually hear an eruption from the crowd in Japan. Mm. And that's because they want to see you keep prevailing and keep fighting, basically. So not so much in the West where it's like if a big move is hit, that's what's going to get the big reaction because it's like this crazy funky looking move that people are like, oh my God, that looks so like painful and dangerous.
So does that mean you would almost engineer the matches to be shorter or longer depending on what market you're in?
Correct, correct.
Because the way you're saying that, it sounds like you'd in Japan you'd want to have a longer match.
Yes, right? Yeah. And it's like in Japan – they'll pay what they pay. Say it's the equivalent of what an Aussie fan pays for their seated tickets, and it's the same kind of like seat for seat kind of view. In Japan, they actually want the show to keep going because they want to get more value for their money. Whereas in the West, and like, you know, definitely in Australia from firsthand experience, we need to make the show quite tight because attention spans are so short that, like, if we're. I've been at shows that have gone over 3 hours and the crowd's just dead. And once the final bell's rung for the main event, they're getting out of there and they're going straight to their car and fucking off.
So what's a good length of show?
I think 2 hours is pretty much like for a live show. Mm. That's the perfect spot. 2 hours 15 is like okay. 2 hours 30 you can get away with. And we just had like a really big show at the Roundhouse that went 2 hours 45 on the dot.
Yeah.
That's probably the max that we would want to go.
And so how many wrestling fixtures do you have within that? Is there
we had 8 matches for 2 hours and 45 minutes, and that included a steel cage match for the main event.
Hectic.
So, yeah, we gave them a broad spectrum of wrestling that night, and there was probably around 40 to 50 wrestlers featured on that show.
Wow. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of stress as well, though. So,
why was it stressful for you?
Just because it was like the Roundhouse is such a big show for us. We had been there before, but with New Japan Pro Wrestling. So it wasn't like a homegrown, home built show.
Yeah.
So to do it as PWA on our own, we did have a New Japan Pro Wrestler, Shingo Takagi, come and compete, but it was still a PWA event. So it was like everything that was going into it from production to staff to the wrestlers to all the talent on the show was purely home built.
Yeah,
and cool. We got 600 plus people there, which is an achievement for us.
Awesome.
And it was all about, like I mentioned earlier, sticking to time.
Yeah.
And everyone did such a good job hitting their times that the main event didn't overstay its welcome. The crowd wasn't dead by the time the cage match went on. They wanted to see it happen and they were there for it from start to finish. So that's all it's about. It's about not killing the crowd. Because if we go overboard with something else earlier and then the main event goes on and it's just crickets, then that's not what the main event should be. The main event should be people at their absolute most raucous. They're so into it. They're like, you know, one side's cheering for this guy, one side's cheering for that guy. And that's pretty much what we had. So we were very, very proud of that evening. And it was a big step for our company and for Australian wrestling as a whole.
Awesome. When you have people come up to you after the shows, because it seems like you've got not only for wrestling in general, but also for you personally, you got such like obsessive or loyal fans. What are the kinds of stuff that they say to you about you know, what wrestling means to them?
Some of them can be really touching.
Yeah.
Like some people, you can tell that they're a bit nervous coming up to you and talking to you because like in their eyes, you're of a different kind of...
They're awestruck.
Yeah. And like to me, that always catches me off guard because I just feel like a regular bloke.
Yeah, like, just feel like a dude, yeah.
I'm just a dude living his dream of the picture he drew when he was in grade 4. Like that's just me. So if you were there in the audience or not, I'm still going to do the wrestling
thing.
Then
they're like, holy shit, it's Robbie Eagles.
Exactly. Yeah. And so some people come to you and say like, this match you had in 2019 is still my favorite match of all time. I go back and watch it. And like whenever I'm like, I have people on Twitter and stuff that say stuff like, I'm feeling really sad today. So I went and watched this Robbie Eagles match and it helped me feel like a lot better. And it's just incredible that something that I do and am so passionate about can make people feel any which way. Like it can make them feel happy when they're feeling sad or whatever it is. So it is like really humbling to have that experience with the fans firsthand. But then there are some times where it's a bit confronting on the other end where like sometimes they're a bit too over the top and I'm taken back and I'm like, I don't really know how to react to this. I'm going to let you play this out and do what you need to do.
Have you ever had any really weird DMs from people?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. Like
what do they say?
A common one is asking for feet pictures.
I was going to say, has anyone asked you to buy your socks?
Yeah. A big thing for wrestlers is selling your used costume. I always wash mine beforehand.
Yeah.
And a lot of the times it's for display purposes. So people want to go, they'll chuck up a photo of like the main match that you wore that in. For example, like when I've won a title or something, they'll buy the costume.
But you don't know what they're going to do with it.
No. And to be honest, I don't care. If I get the money and they pay up front and it gets shipped and it's with them, it's no longer my problem.
That's so funny. What, any other weird DMs?
Like sometimes
coming to my daughter's birthday party.
I've done a birthday party before. That was a cool but weird experience at the time. It was several years ago, but it's definitely something that I can look back and go, yeah, I did that. Like I showed up to a pre-organized party. Someone else was hired to be the entertainment and they said, hey, can you get Robbie Eagles to come and be a special guest? And I was like, oh, look at me, big shot. And I got to throw a cake in some dude's face as the villain of the party. And then I just took some photos and chuffed off and went about my day. So definitely some really obscure things. We've had also people request to be put through tables and stuff. And it's like, I mean, I don't know if you know what that feels like, but it doesn't feel good. So if someone wants to do it, I'll put you through a table, but it's not, I don't enjoy doing it.
Just go to wrestling school, man.
Yeah. And that's one of those on the job training things. You don't learn how to fall through a table. You just do it for the first time and hope for the best.
Yeah. Wow. How many times have you gone through a table in your life?
At least five, maybe more.
I mean, the first thought once you go through is like, am I still alive?
Yeah. I mean, mine was in spectacular fashion too. Cause like, I don't know if you're familiar with what a choke slam is, but guy grabs you around the throat, picks you up as high as he can, and then slams you like just into the mat. Right. Mm-hmm. I was actually on the edge of the ring and the dude that did this move to me was actually quite tall, choke slammed me from the edge of the ring. So he was inside the ring. I was out of it. And then we went from there to the floor, which is a greater drop than just in the ring, through a table.
Holy shit.
And I just laid there and the crowd said exactly that. They did the holy shit, holy shit. And I'm there, I'm hearing it. And I thought I was like watching a WWF tape or something because I'm like, oh, I've heard that all the time on TV. And I'm like, am I dead? Am I dead? No, my fingers are moving. My legs are moving. I'm okay. But fuck, that sucked.
Man, there must be shit like moments like that where you... You got to pinch yourself. Like, is this really my life?
I have deja vu all the time. Yeah. Like I'll be laying there looking at, it's always looking at the ceiling of a building, especially when there's like cool lighting or there's like a, it's like a dome kind of sort of thing where it's got like a cool ceiling to look at. And I'll wake up and a lot of the times it's usually when I've taken a bad knock and like I was semi out for a couple seconds and I kind of look up and go, I've dreamt about this exact moment before.
Oh.
And whether it's a good dream or a bad dream, I'm not too sure. It depends on where we go for the rest of the match from that point. But yeah, I have that all the time.
What do you think is required for wrestling to really continue to grow in Australia?
I think we got to keep doing what we're doing at the moment because right now it's at an all-time level in terms of like the production, the show from start to finish. So many of the top promotions in Australia are doing all the right things and it's about a collective. Whereas I think when I first started and before I started in the industry, everyone was a bit more selfish. So once their match was on, that's all they worried about. They didn't care about their colleagues or their peers that were on before and after them. Whereas now everyone wants the show to be the best. It's not about, well, I'm on second, but I'm going to steal the show. Like if you're on second, you're the second match. You do the second match job. You do what you have to in that position. So we just got to keep nailing that stuff. But then also it's very much kind of like something we spoke about, might've been off mic, was you don't know who's going to be in the audience.
Yeah.
So back in like the 70s and 80s, wrestling was on, it was televised from Australia, from places like the Horton Pavilion and Festival Hall. And it was a big territory. So you'd have Andre the Giant come here to wrestle the local Australian champion, or you'd have Ric Flair come and Harley Race and all these like legendary wrestlers. Mm. So it's like, what do we do to get it back to that position? Maybe it's on TV. Maybe it's on like a major streaming service. I don't know exactly what the next step is because it could be several.
Yeah.
But it's all about just working to make the shows bigger and bigger each time. The worst thing we would want to do is go, hey, we're going to do a stadium show and we get an eighth of the attendance.
And just kills the vibe.
Yeah. You don't want to do. And I've been at some of those shows where they've really shot for the stars and they haven't filled the seats and you go, it was still a great show, but you could tell the atmosphere was down a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's just, I think that's kind of the next level is just continual growth, move on to the next bigger venue and then try and fill it out. And then,
so it seems like audiences are certainly growing. Is the talent pool growing? Are more people getting interested in getting involved with wrestling?
Yeah, the talent's at an all-time high. Like the people that I've had a hand in training, and even those that I haven't, that I've seen come up from the country over the last 5 years specifically, leaps and bounds where, you know, people like myself and those that started training around my time were. And that's just crazy. It's like, where were you hiding all this time when I first started? And I go, oh, you weren't fucking born yet for some of them. or you were 5 years old when I first started training. So
are there any people that get into wrestling like that want to get trained like later in life?
Yeah, it happens all the time.
Yeah.
I spoke about him earlier. So Grayson Waller in WWE, he is the same age as me. So he's 32.
Okay.
He started training at 26.
Right.
I started training at 18. He's in WWE now. Yep. So proof's in the pudding.
Yeah. So, I mean, what he just had, what the size, the look, the persona, the X factor, what was the secret sauce?
He just has it all. Yeah. He I think he spent years doing MMA instead of wrestling. Like kind of when I was doing wrestling, he was doing MMA. He didn't really take it as far as he could have, but that was just kind of the thing that he did. And then he just got to that crossroads because he and I were actually at some of the same shows as fans back when we were like 16, 17 years old, but we didn't know each other.
Yeah.
And then like when we met, we had all these shared stories, and then it's just like, man, like imagine if you started like at 22 or at 18, like you might've made it much earlier, but he also might not have.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I think about that a lot sometimes about, just because you could have got into something earlier, doesn't mean you might not have been ready.
Yep.
You could have made mistakes. You could have been you were a different person back then, right? So there's all these variables at play. So yeah, I mean it's hard. It was the right time for that person.
Correct.
To go down that path.
Yeah,
you know. But no, that's cool to hear that there's certainly a growing interest in people wanting to, because I mean the shows are nothing unless there's a new talent developing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. People are even starting to get bored of me in Australia, I think. Like they still like me, but if I'm on the shows too often or too frequently, they're like, all right, Robbie, fucking let's get the next guy out. We've seen you before.
But they also want to see you you wrestling a variety of people. They don't want to see you having the same matchup with the same dude.
Correct.
Fucking every, you know what I mean? There's got to be variety. And so a variety of styles of wrestling and different matchups makes it mouth-watering for everyone.
Exactly. Yeah. And for years before this current talent pool that came in, that's pretty much what we were doing. I was wrestling the same people. The promotion might have changed and we'd go from Wollongong to Newcastle to the Blue Mountains to wherever. And we were having slightly different matches, but it was with the same people. So it was almost like, you know, sometimes you'd perform, like there are fans that would follow us to all those shows. And you go, what are you doing? You've already seen this match. You don't need to come 3 hours out of your way to see it again. Like, I know you love it, but like, come on. So it's a very lucky time that we have so many amazing wrestling talents across the country right now. So the matches can be so diverse.
I feel bad myself when I'm doing jokes in front of someone who was at a show an hour earlier. I'm like, it's going to be the same jokes, guys. Yeah. You know, so I can't imagine what it feels like when you're doing a 30-minute wrestling performance with the same guy that someone saw a few days earlier. Yeah, that's wild. Look, one thing I just wanted to kind of finish on is I think it's really cool that you have had this dream from when you were so young. You put in place the steps to do it even before you were too young to properly go and start at an academy. You've done that. You've done that for years. You've juggled it with having to make a living with a regular job. And now you're here saying that you've got a professional career and making a living out of living your dream, and it's been enough to buy you a home. That's just, I think, for so many people, such a cool and inspiring story, because so many people, I guess, are too afraid to either risk it, have these dreams, and they never do anything about it, right? So I guess it'd be interesting just to hear you talk a bit about, what people can do to make those first steps between turning a dream into a reality.
Yeah, I think the main thing is knowledge. For me, I really, not only was I a fan of pro wrestling before I really took that leap into trying it. But I actually went to learn as much about it as I could as, you know, a 14, 15-year-old, especially once the internet became more accessible to me.
Yep.
I was watching documentaries. I was reading autobiographies. I was on message boards and random things of, like, people that knew the inside goss and all that sort of stuff. And as we call it in wrestling, the dirt sheets that reveal some of the backstage stuff. But it was, for me, putting myself in the best position to know as much as I could before I got into it, which is often the issue I see with people that set foot into a training facility for the first time, having done no research.
Yeah.
You go, what did you think you were getting into? Like, it's hard. It's not an easy thing. It's not like you just pay a bunch of money and then someone slaps a label on you and goes, you're a wrestler now, off you go, kid. It's the same as, like, if you had never watched rugby league before and you go to rugby league training thinking, oh yeah, I'm big, I'm stocky, I can run pretty fast, I reckon I could have a crack at that sport. And then you realize how fucking hard it is. Yeah. So I think knowledge is power with everything. You know, I remember when I was in the workforce, turning up to job interviews, and I would never look at the descriptions properly. Mm. And then I'd, like, sit down and kind of try asking and working out what the job is. And then I'd go, oh shit, I don't want to do this. Mm. Like, I should have researched it.
Yeah.
And that's where people go wrong. And I've been in the position of the interviewer interviewing those people that didn't research the job. And you go, what are you doing? Like, you're setting yourself up for failure here.
Do you really want to be here? Yeah.
So I think knowledge is key. Learning everything you can about what you want to go for. So if you have that dream, that's great, but look into it more, because there could be something along the way that you go, that really doesn't match up with my morals, I don't want to do that. And then you might shift your dream to something else, which is fine. And so, like I said, wrestling can come at any age. You don't have to be 18 to start. You could be 32 and give it a crack. And you never know, you could make it. Like, it could take you a year, it could take you 10. Like, it's just, everyone learns at different paces. So I think learning as much about whatever it is that you're so invested in and want to have a crack at before you go and do it is going to put you in an advantage versus everyone else right from the get-go. So that's probably the best thing. And then it's all about risking it, like we kind of mentioned. You just, at some point, whether it's on that first try or it's later on when you've already been, you know, having a few goes at it, just eventually put all your eggs in that basket and give it a go. And that's advice I've been given along the way in my career. And sometimes I was, like, dismissive, and I was like, ah, oh, yeah, but I've got a job, or yeah, I've got a girlfriend, or yeah, I'm doing this. And then eventually I listened to it and I went, this is my time. And it was just, it all worked out perfectly.
You started wrestling, it was 15?
15 in the backyard, 18 professionally.
15 in the backyard. And you're now, what, 32?
32,
and
yeah.
And so over that time, I mean, I have changed so many times. I've become different versions of myself, right, mm-hmm. as you develop, as you mature. And so I imagine that's happened for you. You've changed so many times. You've become different versions of Robbie Eagles. But the constant has been wrestling, right?
Yeah.
So it's just interesting. I wanted to hear you just talk about how has your – it's been like one of the main constants in your life, wrestling. How has wrestling played a part, I guess, in just you developing as a person? Because, I mean, all these other things, including you and all these other variables in your life, have changed, but that's been the one constant. Your relationship with wrestling must have changed again and again over time through that period.
Yeah, and it still does every day.
Yeah.
Because it's an evolving sport. And because of that, I kind of have to, like, whichever direction it's going in, I got to go with that so that I can stay relevant.
Yeah. But it's also, I mean, it's impressive for anyone to be just from such a young age to now, you've been so committed to it that whole time. As you've become different versions of yourself, you're always still, I'm a wrestler first.
Yeah. I think it's, for me, it was a dream when I was young.
Yeah.
And then when I started doing it, even when I was a backyard wrestler, I remember my friends saying, hey, you're really good at this. Mm. And I'm like, well, I'm self-taught. I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah. And then when I started training and people were like, you're having your first match in 2 months, you're pretty good at this. It made me feel secure in who I was and going, this is what I was always built to do.
Mm.
So the thing that I was so in love with from such an early age, and it was my passion still to this day, that security of knowing I was meant to do it, and that reassurance. Yeah. And what it's given me is confidence.
Mm.
You know, I I copped a lot of shit at school for liking wrestling, which was funny because there was other people that were either closet wrestling fans or they were fans, but then when people would be picking on me, they'd join and be like, yeah, fuck you, wrestling shit. Ah. Where it's funny when I catch up with them now and I go, wrestling shit, eh?
Yeah.
Here's my house. You're welcome.
Yeah, eat a dick.
Definitely one person I would love to say that to, but I think he's in jail. So I definitely win on that front. But yeah, for me, it was confidence because as a kid, like I definitely – like among my friends, I felt confident. But then if you put me into other public kind of spaces or like even dating as a young person, I was just so not confident in myself. But then as I grew in wrestling, it made me understand that shit can go wrong. It's all about how you kind of deal with it from that point. Mm. And as for me now, I'm like, well, what's the worst thing that can happen is like, you know, in most people's lives, the worst thing that can happen is someone says no to something, no to a job, no to a proposal, no to dating you, no to buying a house, whatever it may be, right? No, no, no. And then what happens? Like, no doesn't break you. No's not the thing that ends your life.
The worst thing that can happen to you is getting choke slammed through a table.
Yeah.
Right? That's a lot worse.
Yeah. I get carried backstage and I'm like, how was that? And everyone's like, fucking amazing. And I'm like, it felt great.
Yeah. Bleeding from the head, from a chair. Yeah. Okay. That sounds way worse. So yeah. That could help put things in perspective, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Awesome. I think that's been a really solid discussion. I think, I really appreciate your time. Did you want to just give a shout out to where people can find information on where to check out some of the wrestling offers in Sydney? And
yeah, definitely. I mean, like if people follow me on Twitter and Instagram, I'm at @RobbieEagles_ on pretty much all social media. So that's where you can find where I'm going to be performing when I'm in the country. You can follow along my journeys in Japan that way as well. Make sure to check out PWA Black Label. That's arguably the top promotion here in Australia that are going strength to strength. And I've been there since day one. And New Japan Pro Wrestling, of course, and New Japan Tamashii, which is the Oceanic brand that's hitting New Zealand and Australia and hopefully becomes a regular thing, which can be a part of the local industry here and get more jobs for my friends, the guys and girls that I hang out with on a weekly basis.
Awesome. Well, anyone that's out there, go and check out a pro wrestling match. You're not going to regret it. And hopefully you'll see Robbie Eagles at one flying from the skies as the sniper of the skies.
Sniper of the skies.
Hell yeah. Awesome. Thanks so much for coming on. This has been Shit's Gone Sideways.